Walmart has the trusted brands and products your kids need for school.
Like HP Chromebooks.
Yep.
Reebok hoodies.
Yep.
Pokemon pencil cases.
I think you know the answer, but just in case, yes. Go back in style with Walmart.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses. Monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Excuse me, can you take a photo of me?
Sure, but you know, if you had the new Samsung Galaxy Z Flip 6, you could snap your own hands-free selfies.
Really?
Watch, I just flex it to the perfect angle, set it down, and FlexCam with Galaxy AI automatically zooms for the perfect shot.
Whoa.
Post-worthy.
New profile pic-worthy.
Flex the newest Galaxy AI foldable Z Flip 6. Get yours now at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. FlexCam length varies and is shorter than standard zoom length. Galaxy AI provided free until end of 2025 on supported devices.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Kevin Lochgren about his book titled Parks for Profit, Selling Nature in the City, published by Columbia University Press in 2022. This book investigates a new kind of city urban park that has emerged in the early 21st century. I admit, of the parks that are discussed in this book, I am most familiar with the High Line in New York. Perhaps listeners are familiar with that one as well. Honestly, I had never really thought about just how strange this park is in a lot of senses. And reading in this book about how this park even came to be, how other parks like it came to be, is way more interesting than I ever would have thought. So, Kevin, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to take us into and behind the scenes of these parks.
For sure. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Miranda. I really appreciate it.
Before we get too far into parks, though, could you introduce yourself a bit to our audience and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So my name's Kevin Lochgren. I'm an assistant professor of sociology at Temple University in Philadelphia, in the United States. And before that, I was at Rice University and Northwestern University, where I did my PhD in sociology. And I've sort of been on this urban parks thing for probably like close to 15 years now. It started when I was a master's student and living in New York City, and was living in New York at the time that the High Line opened in 2009. And so was very sort of, in a lot of ways, sort of naive to anything about, you know, how New York City worked. I was probably, I guess, 23 years old at the time, and hadn't lived there really previously. So I was really fascinated by the way that the High Line was just this, you know, tremendously celebrated public space, and just a phenomenon beyond just like the fact that it was like a park and a public space. It was just seemed like a lot of people seemed very excited about it. And you know, New York, to me, as a young adult, you know, always struck me as a place where you weren't supposed to be excited about things. You were supposed to sort of have this cynical sort of hard edge about anything that seemed, you know, seemed cool. It was cooler to kind of not think it was cool. And so it sort of surprised me how much people really were celebrating it, and how popular it really quickly became. And so at the time, I was really interested in sort of learning about sort of urban history and urban political economy. And it just sort of became a space that felt sort of accessible. I was able to sort of start doing my first, you know, ethnographic work as a young graduate student in the park. And, you know, parks are obviously very accessible to students as places to study, because you don't generally need people's permission. You just can walk into the space and be there and see what's going on. And so I honestly, if you had told me in 2009 or 2010, when I really started the project, that I would eventually write a book about it, I don't know that that was my plan at the time. But, you know, the longer I've been in academia, I feel like these projects have just such long lifespans, and you just, a lot of the time, the easiest path is just to kind of move forward with what you've already been looking at, and to try to find new and interesting angles at the same topic. And so, Yeah, I really, the journey of the project was really, you know, kind of my journey through graduate school and into my postdoctoral training at Rice, where I was able, you know, to kind of expand the study, you know, starting in New York, moving to Chicago, and then ending up in Houston. And those are the three cities that, that sort of are home to the three case study parks in the book. And so it really was, I don't know, kind of it was a little bit of an autobiographical journey through sociology and through urban development, and a lot of just sort of serendipity in terms of living in New York when the High Line opened, living in Chicago when the Bloomingdale Trail, also known as the 606, opened, and then being in Houston shortly after Buffalo Bayou Park had effectively reopened, and then also being there when it was really disastrously flooded in 2017 by Hurricane Harvey. And so I feel like for me as an urbanist, you know, to credibly write about a place, I think it's so important to really know it in a sort of, you know, almost on a sort of bodily level, and feel like, you know, I'm not from any of these places, but I certainly would not want to write about a place that I didn't feel like I could do justice to, you know, the sort of the local perspectives, and to feel like I, on some deep level, felt like I understood how things worked. And so I was fortunate to be in these places and be in them for, you know, 3 to 5 years each. And so I feel like that gave me a really good grounding and confidence in my ability to kind of analyze what was going on. So I'll sort of stop there, but I certainly could say more about the genesis of the book.
Well, no, that's a very helpful introduction. I think also gives us an overview, as you said, of the main parks you focus on, and this kind of mixture of, like, it's about how we understand these things sociologically, historically, even economically in the book, and also, like, actually, what is it like being in one of those parks, right? Mm. And what does it feel like to be there? What does it look like to be there? Which is such a part of the book as well. So I think before I ask you about each of the parks sort of in a bit more detail in and of themselves, I want to kind of keep thinking about them at this bigger picture level as, like, a category of park, I suppose, or a grouping. Mm. Because one thing that, I mean, it struck me so much that I mentioned it even just introducing the book, that these parks are kind of odd in a way. They're even a bit strange, both in sort of the colloquial way we use that word and sometimes the way we use it in, for example, you know, Gothic literature as well. Mm. So can you kind of tell us about that? You know, defamiliarize these parks for listeners. How are they strange? How are they maybe subverting ideas about what a park is in an urban area?
Yeah, it's a big question. It's something I feel like I've struggled with, as I've, especially once I sort of started looking more at the sort of the landscape architectural aspects of the spaces, because, like I mentioned, I sort of initially was kind of coming from political economy and then sort of came into it more, more looking at the aesthetics of the spaces and looking at really kind of varied sort of sources, anything from, like, aesthetic philosophy to learning landscape architectural history to learning about some of the more, you know, just the more kind of recent design influences that led to these spaces to look so new and different. In terms of categorizing them, I think that's sort of been an ongoing, and I don't even think that I really love what I call them in the book, which is post-industrial parks, because I think that is very broad and vague, but I'm not someone who's too, I tend to not get too worried about sort of the specifics when it comes to categorizing things. And I think that's what a lot of our sociological sort of training would sort of lead us to, kind of creating these ideal types and creating these categories of whatever it is we're studying, and in this case, social spaces or public spaces or parks. Because there's certainly, you know, one could quibble with, you know, what exactly is post-industrial? What does that mean? For me, I sort of was taking it more at the level of the broader urban landscape in which these parks are situated. Because I guess in a certain sense, right, like the train tracks themselves, you know, are sort of an infrastructural space that is related to older sort of industries in these cities. You know, how are they specifically post-industrial? It's I'm looking at it very broadly and pretty open-endedly. And Houston, the case is so different. So let me slow down and sort of break down what they are, because I think that You know, as you mentioned, Miranda, being most familiar with the High Line, and I think most people that I've talked to about the book, that tends to be the case for a lot of reasons. I think it's certainly been the most famous one, and it sort of has a claim to being first in a certain sense. I mean, again, these are some of the details that other people who study these parks can kind of quibble with. It's sort of like, what do you want to have as your sort of origin point? Because there are examples going back to the 1960s. There are examples of sort of what could be described as post-industrial parks. There are more recent examples in the 90s of sort of, you know, the conversion of older railways into parks. So I'm certainly not, again, I'm also not super invested in, like, was the High Line truly the first post-industrial park? It's sort of irrelevant to me. But I think that what is relevant and what is interesting about it is that it really sort of changed what parks, you know, could be in the eyes of urban elites and power brokers across the world. Because I think that, as I talk about in the book, you really have to go back to the 19th century and the sort of creation of large picturesque parks like Central Park in New York City in the 1850s, where to find a time period where urban elites really cared about parks as these sort of cultural objects, as these things that could sort of build the prestige and build potentially the economic power of the city. You know, usually, again, going back to that period, parks became a sort of way to validate wealth in places that were sort of rapidly accumulating wealth. So for, like, the elites of Chicago in, you know, later in that century, it was sort of like, we need to hire Frederick Olmsted. We need to get the guy who built Central Park to come here and give us a Central Park. And so if you've been to the south side of Chicago in the vicinity of the University of Chicago, actually the what's now called Washington and Jackson Parks, and along the Midway, that was all conceived as one sort of contiguous park called South Park. And so there's this history of these sort of urban boosters seeking out parks for their sort of for building the image of their city. And I think the High Line, you know, again, we can sort of say maybe there were some previous examples, but to me, there's no question that the High Line is what sort of changed that sort of calculus for urban elites around the world, that you could build parks that could have a sort of civic purpose, but that would also have this, you know, cultural benefit and this economic benefit. And so for me, it was really interesting to sort of trace, you know, the emergence of this form, both as a sort of political and economic object, but also a cultural object, as it sort of moved into these new contexts, just like the sort of picturesque parks did in earlier eras. And so you certainly could have, you know, in terms of the case studies for the book, you know, the High Line would certainly, you know, almost, you know, necessarily, you know, need to be in the book. But I think there are so many examples one could select. I think for me, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, I wanted to pick parks that I felt like I really understood in a lived way. And I think that, again, part of it was sort of convenience of being in these places. But I do think being able to have this cross-regional comparison, obviously all within the United States, I certainly could have looked globally at all kinds of different spaces. But that's sort of, I guess I'm not fully answering your question, because I do think it's important to provide context what the other spaces kind of look like. Obviously, anyone listening to this can Google Bloomingdale Trail, aka the 606, which is sort of probably the most similar to the High Line, built on this old elevated railway. Very different sort of piece of infrastructure. So not being kind of on the elevated sort of stilts like the High Line, but being kind of on top of this concrete basin that was filled with dirt. So it offered a very different kind of architectural intervention for the folks who built the 606. Buffalo Bayou Park, from my mind, sort of repurposes the same kind of linear walking path and a lot of what I describe as an imbrication of sort of objects representing the city, quote unquote, and objects representing nature, quote unquote, but doing it in a different context along an urban waterway, Buffalo Bayou. So this very kind of slow moving, heavily transformed in the past through engineering efforts, and also if you kind of zoom out to the more regional scale, Buffalo Bayou, which is the central waterway of Houston and the surrounding region. At the eastern end, before it goes into the Gulf of Mexico, is sort of transformed into the Houston Ship Channel. And so it's one of the most heavily industrialized and polluted waterways imaginable. And so the idea that it's also connected to this like highly aestheticized, highly beautified space is also, I mean, also points to a sort of an interesting paradox that I try to explore in the book in terms of how our kind of urban elites constructing nature, like what does this seem to mean for people who have the resources and the political capital to actually build these spaces. So again, I'll sort of cut myself off again. I feel like I'm starting to rant a little bit.
Well, no, that's helpful context and introduction to the three parks. I wonder if we can kind of continue on that train you were coming to towards the end of that answer around kind of who is using the parks and who's deciding who is using the parks. Can you talk a bit about sort of the race lines, the class lines, the gender lines that these parks are kind of tapping into that urban parks more generally perhaps have been doing without necessarily all of us noticing it for quite a while now?
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And let me introduce you to a terrific new podcast series, A Sense of Rebellion. A Sense of Rebellion is a captivating new 10-part podcast from Yevgeny Morozov and our friends at Post Utopia and The Syllabus. A decade in the making, it began as a doctoral dissertation featuring a score by Brian Eno. That's right, Brian Eno. The podcast explores a forgotten yet fascinating countercultural project at the dawn of the digital revolution. From LSD and the Rockefellers to AI and the CIA, each episode blends drama, mystery, and meticulous archival research. Don't miss out on A Sense of Rebellion, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Walmart has the trusted brands and products your kids need for school.
Like HP Chromebooks.
Yep.
Reebok hoodies.
Yep.
Pokemon pencil cases.
I think you know the answer, but just in case, yes. Go back in style with Walmart.
Sure. Yeah, I think for me, a lot of my analytical approach to the book was looking at the sort of the top-down sort of aspect in terms of the creation of the spaces through both looking at the architects and landscape architects, as well as looking at the sort of political power brokers and in some cases the sort of private philanthropic leaders who especially in cases like Houston were really central. So thinking about mayors and city councils and people who were sort of in the development sort of side of things broadly conceived. So I didn't necessarily collect data on sort of park use, which I think is super important. It is something that I think struggle with sort of my lack of sort of inclusion of that. And I certainly hope that, and obviously there are people doing work on those kinds of questions. And I think that it's something that I have a lot of thoughts about, having spent a lot of time in these spaces, but I don't necessarily feel like I systematically can speak to that. But I think that one of the things that is certainly very surprising, for example, when the Highline opened, was just like how white the space felt, just on a sort of anecdotal level. And given that Chelsea, the neighborhood around the Highline, is sort of one of the kind of last vestiges of some semblance of ethno-racial diversity in Lower Manhattan, given the sort of sweeping gentrification of so much of that part of the city, in which the High Line certainly played a large role in, and it's adjacent to a large public housing complex. And so it is interesting sort of the way that the parks programming, because these parks are so heavily programmed, which I find really curious. And that's part of, there's a whole thing we could certainly talk about, sort of the role of sort of these private groups like the Friends of the High Line, who have sort of taken control of these spaces in ways that, which isn't unique to these three parks. It's certainly a sort of broader sort of like neoliberal public space problem. But I do think that there's no question in my mind that there's a certain kind of upscale presentation of commerce and of programming that to me has historically, and it's sort of only a 15-year history, has not been very inclusive, and has sort of catered to the same sort of like upper middle class white demographic that, you know, certainly in the case of the High Line and in the 606 to a lesser extent, but Buffalo Bayou Park's kind of a little, I mean, it's hard to talk about them as one coherent thing. So I'll just talk about the High Line for a second. But I think that, you know, there was a lot of community support that was mobilized by the Friends of the High Line. This was a space that the Local Growth Coalition, led by Mayor Rudy Giuliani, wanted to destroy the High Line throughout the 1990s. It was unclear, especially after 9/11, if this was going to be a priority for the city. But there had been this pretty substantial mobilization of sort of cultural and economic resources by a more kind of middle class sort of, you could call it a sort of a bottom up sort of process. Initially, to really build support for turning this old railway into a public park. And I think that that sort of clientele, which in a lot of ways represented a sort of gentrified, the newer sort of population of that, of the Chelsea community, you know, became sort of the, you know, the sort of stewards of the space. And I think that a lot of these spaces have been kind of created in the image of the people who have played a large role in sort of preserving them and in developing them as parks. And I think that what we see in the spaces tends to reflect the dominant interests. It tends to sort of reflect the way that upper middle class white urbanites want to kind of be in public space. And so I think that there's a lot of things going on in terms of what I feel and sort of talk about in the book a little bit. But again, like I said, I don't really have, you know, systematic sort of analysis of this, but I do think that there is without question a sort of a veneer of exclusivity that's very racialized. I don't know, you know, to your question, I don't know to the extent to which it's a sort of a gendered exclusivity. But I do think that there's, you know, when we think about the sort of traditional gendering of public parks in the US and in Western Europe, that there's always kind of been this they're sort of been constructed, this goes back to like Frederick Olmsted, this sort of like, this can become a sort of feminine public realm, a sort of a, you know, a safe space for white women and children, is kind of really explicitly been a lot of what has sort of driven park development in different places in different times. And so there is something kind of, there's a long kind of cultural current, I think, in when we're talking about gender in public spaces generally, and certainly in parks. And something I don't talk about in the book, but you have me thinking about this now, I think part of the divergence and the sort of, you know, like you're saying, the strangeness of these spaces is how little they kind of reflect the sort of the traditional sort of like spaces of sort of white femininity, like, you know, having these sort of picnic grounds or having playgrounds. Like it's really about like a familial setting that these parks, there certainly are gestures towards that. And I don't, and I'm not taking a normative position on like whether, you know, whether it's good or bad or whatever. It's just, this is just, to me, this is how things are. But it is interesting that these are much more adult spaces in a lot of ways, right? So the way that parks, like I was saying, like traditionally slices of parks or certain kinds of parks were kind of really explicitly for women and children, those kind of micro spaces don't tend to exist in the same kind of number that we might see in a place like Central Park or something like that. So it is sort of an interesting sort of shift in, again, when we're thinking about the clientele of the spaces. Who wants to go wander around and look at like fancy buildings? Like, I have two young children. I don't know that they would really want to do that for very long. Like, they'd be like, where are the swing sets? You know, it, so it is an interesting sort of thing architecturally, and who they're attempting to kind of bring into the spaces is very interesting. And then that also points to the whole question of accessibility that I talk about in the book as well. In the last chapter, just thinking about the idea that, you know, these spaces are not really accessible in terms of like, if you're walking along the street, you might see this kind of this park hanging overhead, and it's not immediately clear how do you get there. There's also a sort of lack of access, and so like the High Line, when it initially opened, only had one elevator, the 606 has a lot of ramps. I think there's only one set of stairs because accessibility was very important to the designers. But it is, again, it is a sort of, there's a sort of like an embodiment that you're sort of expected to have, right? You're expected to be able to comfortably climb four flights of stairs and then walk a couple of miles in this narrow passageway with not a lot of comfortable seating, not a lot of things that are going to sort of occupy children. So it is a curious thing. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, kind of listed all like that together. It's like, okay, this is definitely a particular vision of who should be in the park and how they should be using it. And as you discuss in the book, this isn't restricted just to kind of the areas of these parks. Can you talk a bit about kind of perhaps for the New York and Chicago ones in particular, how the development of these parks has led to changes in the neighborhoods around them as well?
For sure. I mean, I think that it's interesting because with the High Line having sort of the longest, I guess, sort of history at this point, how the co-founders of the group have, you know, in the written record have expressed regret about the way to which the neighborhood changed, you know, and to what extent they could have done anything to stop it. I sort of have some empathy for them. I think that this was a much bigger, much more structural process of redeveloping, you know, the Lower West Side of Manhattan, and a lot of that had to do with Michael Bloomberg's vision when he became mayor, you know, for how the transformation of the West Side was going to unfold. And you know, the High Line became, even while it was being developed, it became a little bit of a delicate issue for the people who had supported it, because it had clearly merged with the sort of top-down interests of the Bloomberg administration and all of the real estate developers on the West Side who were sort of eager to see this park increase land values, increase tax revenues. You know, the fact that like the Whitney Museum moved to the foot of the High Line, the idea that, you know, that the West Side rail yards were redeveloped as Hudson Yards, and that and now you have Little Island right there. Like there were a lot of other sort of mechanisms. You know, I think that I tend to look at these things, you know, as a sociologist, much more kind of structurally. And I think that like it's very tempting to sort of say like the High Line caused this or the 606 caused this, but I think that these things are very intertwined. And I think that these were places that were already gentrifying. You know, they were already sort of becoming really intriguing spaces for development. I think it's interesting in the book to be able to trace this sort of emergence of the different spaces over time. So you mentioned Chicago, and I have a photo in the book in the little photo area where there was a new condos being developed, and they were really explicitly had this huge billboard, you know, live on the 606. So a really explicit gesture to the idea that, you know, the park is this upscale space and look at this upscale housing that we're building and your lifestyle can really be part of this like cool, you know, very hip urban already kind of scene. And obviously for people who lived in these neighborhoods for a long time, there's a tremendous, you know, sense of inequality because, you know, so sticking with Chicago for a second, you know, like the neighborhoods around the 606, Wicker Park, Bucktown, Logan Square, and Humboldt Park, you know, these for basically since the 1950s had been predominantly Latino areas, and that was, you know, that population was increasingly getting pushed out as the sort of white population was sort of moving west from Wicker Park. There's, you know, a lot of like Richard Lloyd is somebody who's written about sort of neo-bohemia in this area. And so it's kind of that now kind of classic story of like a bunch of artists and creative types move to this area because it's interesting and it's affordable, but over time they become the dominant group. And so I think there was a lot of interesting sort of gentrification, very racialized sort of fault line with the 606 because of the fact that it ran east and west through these different areas, Bucktown and Wicker Park, which had really become very firmly white and gentrified by 2000, and Logan Square and Humboldt Park to the west, which were becoming gentrified, but not nearly to the same degree. And Humboldt Park, which had really been sort of the historical home of the city's Puerto Rican population, and there had been a lot of sort of cultural institutions around the Puerto Rican community there that had really, I think, worked to sort of strengthen that neighborhood as almost like the last bastion, because so many Latino folks had been pushed west in the preceding decades in the 70s, 80s, 90s. So there was this interesting sort of tension where a lot of people in Humboldt Park, the neighborhood, had been pushing the city to improve Humboldt Park, which is also confusingly the park, very large picturesque park at the center of the neighborhood, pushing the city to improve the park, to clean it, etc., for many years, and nothing ever happens. And then now that there's sort of more white people living in the vicinity around 2000, very suspiciously, the city starts to kind of make some improvements. City's making investment in this area. And so the 606 was sort of part of a gentrification question before it even opened, because it was sort of seen as an amenity that people in Humboldt Park and Logan Square would have appreciated. But there became this question of, well, who is it being built for? Is this the next and possibly final blow in the Latino community here? Like, this seems like this is going to be nice. And initially in the redevelopment process, a lot of those like Puerto Rican cultural institutions and political institutions that I mentioned were supporters of the Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail. The Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail was a nonprofit group like the Friends of the High Line. And they tried to be very inclusive. They had their public-facing documents were in English and in Spanish. Ultimately, as I talk about in the book, they sort of get pushed out by Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the Trust for Public Land. So they ultimately don't kind of balloon into this, you know, huge kind of private organization the way that the Friends of the High Line did in New York. But again, it was just very interesting to kind of follow that story in Chicago, because, you know, there was a protest on the 606 before it even opened about displacement and about the problems of gentrification that were becoming symbolically and very, you know, structurally attached to the development of this park. And so I think that the parks are certainly very potent symbols of gentrification because of the visibility of them and sort of the celebration of them architecturally and civically. And so, yeah, the Chicago case, I think, is super interesting for thinking about what that all looks like. And I think that I mentioned sort of briefly sort of in the conclusion of the book with the Houston case, where things have been so much more led by private groups and by philanthropists who have a sort of, who again are sort of being, I think, schooled on the need to at least appear inclusive, right? Even if it's done very cynically, there's an understanding because of how the High Line, you know, so there's certainly nothing new for me for this book to come out in 2022 and to talk about the High Line is related to gentrification. It's sort of like, well, obviously people have been talking about that for a decade. And so I think that there's been significant pushback to this idea that, like, well, are these parks actually good? Are they, who are they for? What kind of impact are they going to have on a community? And so it's been interesting in Houston, where there's a much longer and more powerful tradition of private groups really kind of dominating local politics, that the people who, the Kinder Foundation, who's the principal private donors behind Buffalo Bayou Park, have now given money to the Emancipation Park Conservancy, for example, which is this historically one of the only spaces that Black people could use until the end of Jim Crow in Houston. And so it's really interesting, again, the sort of the optics of some of these. I mean, and I should note, I think the donation, I don't want to get this wrong, but I want to say it was like $1 million, whereas obviously they're giving hundreds of millions of dollars between Buffalo Bayou Park and this new Memorial Park redevelopment that they're also financing. So there's a huge, you know, so again, there's a sort of optical, symbolic sort of, you know, politics of, you know, the sort of top-down politics of inclusion, and what does that look like? And as I talk about in the book, I think it's being mobilized very cynically in response to you know, what's happened with the Highline, what's happened with the 606, where there is clearly this very racialized displacement at play. And it's not a secret, right, that there's been significant pushback by the people who've been getting pushed out.
No, this is helpful to understand how these things go together, and kind of the structures, as you said, that the parks are kind of coming out of and then also obviously enhancing. What about, given that you've just helpfully explained the kind of private organizations and some of the ways they've been key in really all three parks, what about the mayors of the cities? Can you talk about kind of how, you know, what role do they have in determining when these parks go forward, how these parks go forward, who these parks are for?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think that there are definitely some idiosyncrasies. And this is where I think it's helpful to kind of have the three cases, because I think if you were just looking at New York or just looking at Chicago, you might say, oh, the mayors are hugely important. But then you go to Houston, it's like, well, the mayor there, there were several mayors who were sort of in place through the redevelopment process. And you would say, they don't seem like they had a huge role in this. And so I think that there are certain kind of like idiosyncrasies in terms of what local growth coalitions look like in terms of who has power. And I think that and who their sort of constituencies are, right? Because I think that for somebody like Bloomberg or Emanuel in Chicago and in New York, a lot of their supporters came from real estate, came from finance. So they're these sort of white collar workers were sort of their base of support. And so thinking about what a sort of push to build parks would look like for someone who had like a more working class or a more racially diverse sort of, you know, constituency probably would look very different. And so I think that these were mayors who were able to kind of, I think, really successfully wield the sort of channels of influence that they had available. And I think Emanuel is a really interesting case in Chicago where as a sort of, you know, having had a lot of experience in federal government, was able to get, I want to say, 90% of the project funded through a federal act, the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement Grant Program. So this you know, federal allocation of money for building bike lanes and things like that, Emanuel was able to use that to build this, you know, very fancy, very sort of, you know, glorified sort of park space, something that would have really, you know, in a lot of ways diverged from like a humble bike lane or something like that, the things that probably were more typically being built with this money. And he did that in part, and this is, you know, something I get into the book, is sort of trying to get into the sort of history of parks development within the three cities, you know, as sort of efficiently as I can, because obviously there's a lot to kind of juggle in the book. But I think for Emanuel, the fact that Richard M. Daley, who was the mayor prior to him, had just built Millennium Park in the Loop in downtown Chicago, this very iconic postmodern space, and that had, I cited something in the book. I think it's like 15 of the 17 wealthiest Illinois residents in the state of Illinois had donated to the park. So it was this massive public-private partnership, and the city had, you know, from my understanding, is the city government had really put everything that they had financially into that park. And so for Emanuel to kind of come in and really be driven by this agenda, you know, as a lot of sort of Chicago commentators would sort of note, he was sort of obsessed with this concept of world class. Like, he wanted Chicago to be this world class city, which really, like I was saying at the beginning of our conversation, kind of tapped back into what urban boosters in the 19th century were all about too. It was like, we need to validate this city. We are the second city. We're behind New York. We're behind Los Angeles in terms of how people think about us as a U.S. city. And we need to kind of have something like the High Line. We need to have something better than the High Line. And that all, you know, so that was the agenda. That was the goal. You know, as certainly I talk about exhaustively in the book, you know, there's such an economic factor, you know, building these parks and the way that they're sort of so interwoven with, you know, both the sort of urban, traditional urban spaces and also bringing these traditional forms of nature together in these unique ways. It's reminiscent of, you know, weeds growing in an abandoned parking lot, right? There's just something very kind of like essentially evoking like the idea of like what I call rot in the last chapter, right? This idea of like things are just ruins, right? On some level. And so the idea that you need hundreds of millions of dollars to kind of reconstruct ruins is super interesting, because clearly from the point of view of the urban elites, the mayors, there was a need to do this really well, right? There was an architectural validation. Like if critics didn't like these spaces, then you sort of had a problem, right? You needed to do something that really wowed people. And I think especially with given the sort of universal acclaim that the High Line encountered, you know, for somebody like Mayor Emanuel in Chicago, the stakes were super high. And he raised the stakes through his many public comments, which I quote many of them in the book. You know, he really saw Chicago in competition with New York City. He saw the 606, which, you know, he had a hand in sort of the renaming, which I talk about in the book as well. He really saw this as like, we are taking on New York. We are going to challenge New York for sort of cultural supremacy, and we are going to have a better version of their park. And again, I think above all else, that speaks to the motives of what's behind a lot of these parks, right? Because someone has to find the money for them. And what are the motivations of those people who are finding the money or putting up the money? There's a lot of ego involved, right? A lot of ego, both personally for the mayors or the philanthropists, as well as sort of a projection of like the urban ego, if you will, for their whole city. So that's sort of how I would look at it. Yeah, at least I think Rahm Emanuel is probably the best example of like this sort of strong-willed mayor who was just so single-mindedly focused on like doing this for all of the sort of cynical reasons.
Excuse me, can you take a photo of me?
Sure, but you know, if you had the new Samsung Galaxy Z Flip 6, you could snap your own hands-free selfies.
Really?
Watch, I just flex it to the perfect angle, set it down, and FlexCam with Galaxy AI automatically zooms for the perfect shot.
Whoa.
Post-worthy.
New profile pic-worthy.
Flex the newest Galaxy AI foldable, Z Flip 6. Get yours now at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. FlexCam length varies and is shorter than standard zoom length. Galaxy AI provided free until end of 2025 on supported devices.
This episode is brought to you by Ollie. Back to school means food changes. Early breakfasts, school lunches, after-school snacks, and let's not even talk about dinner. Ollie's here to help you cover all the wellness bases, from daily multivitamins to belly-balancing probiotics. Ollie's got your fam covered. Buy three and get one free with code BUNDLE24 at OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Can you tell us a bit about what you just mentioned, the name of it? Why is it called the 606?
So I find it very kind of telling in a lot of ways in terms of the development process, right? So the train was the Bloomingdale line, the Bloomingdale elevated line. And so when it was abandoned, I think in the early 1990s, and then there was an interest in sort of reviving it as a public space. And this was sort of, again, this is sort of pre-High Line. There were plans to do this well before the High Line came along in a more sort of rails to trails type sort of idea, which is pretty common in a lot of the sort of more rural Rust Belt of the United States. But this was a sort of, the people who were kind of behind this, Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail Group, had an interest in basically making it a bike path. It was a very kind of modest goal, and they raised some money and they pushed to get the, you know, the City Planning Commission to put it on the agenda each year. And eventually it seemed like it was kind of moving its way procedurally up the kind of priority list. And so by the time Emanuel took office, and I don't want to get the year wrong, but I want to say it's like 2011 or so, you know, this was already kind of an option. This was something the city government already kind of knew about as something that, hey, there are people who want to do this.
there's, you know, plans. This is, you know, we can kind of just loop into this. And so it seemed pretty straightforward, I think, for the, you know, similarly to the High Line. It's like, this was always called the High Line. Buffalo Bayou Park. This is Buffalo Bayou. There's a certain sort of simplicity to how these spaces are typically named, because they're not being invented out of whole cloth. They're typically being just repurposed in some way, and they typically already had a name of some kind. And so the Bloomingdale Trail certainly makes sense to me as a name for the space. But what eventually happened is that, because the Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail did not really have the kind of economic capital at their disposal the way that like the Friends of the High Line did. And if people listening are interested in that, the New York Times coverage of a lot of the sort of celebrity involvement in the sort of development years, like 2004 to 2006, super interesting to kind of see all the different sort of celebrities that got involved, people from the fashion world and things like that. In the Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail did not have celebrities who were backing them. They did not have, you know, millionaire donors who were writing huge checks. It was a very grassroots, traditionally grassroots kind of thing, you know, people donating $25, $100, things like that. And so what ultimately happened is that they were sort of forced out of the project as it escalated through the Emanuel administration. The Trust for Public Land is sort of brought in as the private partner, because again, we inhabit this neoliberal urban development terrain where it's sort of almost expected that these kinds of spaces are public-private partnerships. It's almost expected that there's a conservancy or a friends group who's behind it. It's like the idea that like the city parks department would just manage the space is just, it almost seems like an impossibility. I think it would, if that happened and someone proposed a really interesting new park and there was no friends group, I think people would be very surprised by that, because there's just so much private money that, you know, wants to go into these spaces. And so the Trust for Public Land, being this national group that had been doing these public-private partnerships since, I think, the 1970s, was brought in, and they were able to do a lot more fundraising. Eventually, private corporations like Boeing get involved. And so a lot of the more kind of big ticket sort of donors are now involved, and the Trust for Public Land, no one's exactly, I think there's probably at the time there were different people who wanted to take credit for it. I think probably no one really wants to take credit for it now, but people like Beth White, who was really involved on the private side of things with the 606 Mayor Emanuel, it was somehow a collaboration between the City of Chicago and the Trust for Public Land. I've been told that there was a consulting firm that was hired, and that they are the ones who came up with the name. Whoever came up with it, the reason for the name change was because, as Emanuel and others would tell it, the park needed to be bigger. That the Bloomingdale Trail was nice, but it doesn't evoke the sort of the grand vision that Emanuel and colleagues had. And so 606, I mean, I sort of, you know, make my feelings on this pretty obvious in the book, and I guess I'm doing that right now too. 606 is the first three numbers of every Chicago zip code. So it was seen as this symbolic gesture that this park is for the whole city. This is for everyone. And this number will resonate with everyone because we all get our mail. So there was a lot of resentment about this decision, both in terms of the local community groups, not just, you know, Friends of the Bloomingdale Trail, but just people in the community who supported it. People who were on the design team were really vehemently opposed to this name change. But I guess money talks, and it's now called the 606. They opened the park on June 6th, right? So they were very invested in 606 is going to be our thing. I find it a bit silly, but that is, and so in the book, I felt like I sort of had to call it both, which was a little clunky, but and when I talk about it, I tend to say the 606, because I think that's what most people the name change has been successful in a certain sense. I don't know that a lot of people again, because now the park is almost, it's a decade old. I don't know if a lot of people are clinging to the Bloomingdale Trail name anymore, but yeah, the branding effort, I guess, was successful at least getting people to call it that.
Mm. Well, and the story behind it is really interesting. So thank you for sharing it with us. Is there anything that can be done about this? The ego, the kind of who gets access and who doesn't. Are there ways to make these parks more equitable?
It's a really good question. And I you know, in the last chapter of the book, I sort of try to steer it into more abstract terrain, because I confess that I often find it a little bit sort of disappointing when you read this, you know, super powerful book about something, you know, some kind of inequality in the world, and then you get to the last chapter and it's like very kind of milquetoast, like policy recommendations. And so no disrespect to people who offer such recommendations. I'm sure they're very useful. But for me, I was like, I would feel like there would be kind of a letdown in terms of the sort of the narrative frenzy that I felt like I had been kind of building in the preceding 180 pages. And so the last chapter, where I kind of call for a sort of a decolonization of park aesthetics, which is like so abstract, it's like, what does that even mean? But, you know, I spend so much time in the book showing how a lot of these park aesthetics that we take for granted are really essentially about colonization and about whiteness, and that even though park forms have transformed, a lot of these kind of founding ideas of landscape architecture, which are not ideas that I think a lot of people would want to celebrate, that are so implicit and so kind of built in that we don't even necessarily recognize what these parks have been historically, in terms of, you know, colonizing places and ecosystems, and thinking about, well, how can we relearn what we think of as the aesthetics of nature? How can we not see, you know, quote unquote, good nature as being connected to whiteness, for example? And so one of the other things I talk about in the, you know, I have this idea that we should abolish private parks, park corporations. So I call them corporations in the book, which people who run the groups might object to, but I feel like it's really important to lay their interests bare. And I feel like these groups don't serve the public. They trade on a lot of sort of civic rhetoric, right? And this idea of being friends, right? And I'm from the Philadelphia area. We've got a long Quaker tradition here. And so friends are kind of, you know, who doesn't like their friends, right? And it's such an inoffensive, friendly kind of name, right? And so I think it kind of effectively shields what in my mind is really going on, which is that these become vehicles for people with a lot of money to rebuild cities in their own image and not be accountable to the public, to be able to really have a degree of not just financing, but oversight of the spaces. And that's something that I talk about in that last chapter, is that, you know, there's always in the US, there's always been private influence in these public spaces. Like not like this was just this purely a neoliberal invention. In part, it's escalated because of the retrenchment of the public sector in the last 50 years. But, you know, the idea that there were groups like the Hull House, for example, like that was a private organization. They were involved in mobilizing for parks in Chicago. The Urban League, another example, right? So, but there's this shift where these private groups have shifted from park advocates to sort of park organizers and controllers of parks, and being tasked with running the day-to-day and really kind of leaving the public park districts as these kind of secondary actors who, you know, are increasingly seeing budget cuts, who by no means have the resources to build or maintain these kinds of spaces. There is something that's so you know, that's just so like challenging and frustrating, I think, about the sort of way that these parks are so heavily designed in ways that require so much maintenance, right? And that's something that I do respect about the folks who designed the 606, like Francis Whitehead, who really prioritized a space that could be a sort of permaculture, that could sort of sustain itself, that didn't need to be, you know, rebuilt with, you know, Brazilian rainforest wood, which was, that was, you know, going back to this question of like the protests of these spaces, that was, I think, the very first protest of the High Line, was that they were bringing in, you know, Brazilian wood to build the sort of planking system. And so there's a question for me in terms of sustainability, and that's obviously a buzzword that people like to throw around, and it basically is a cipher at this point. But I think that just on a sort of very elemental level, like, can these spaces be sustained without tens and hundreds of millions of dollars continuing to go into them, when all of these spaces are located in cities that have broader public park systems that are terribly underfunded, and that is completely racist and unevenly developed in terms of where parks are located, which parks are maintained, which parks have resources. So when you really kind of center the High Line, the Bloomingdale Trail, 606, and Buffalo Bayou Park within those kind of broader urban frameworks, it's to me, I struggle to kind of understand why the parks are needed. You know, I respect the sort of the landscape architects and the architects who have these visions for really interesting spaces. But the challenge I would put, you know, to people on the design side is sort of like, how can you do, can you build something that's cool and interesting without relying on billionaires to keep giving money to a private group for people to be able to use the space? Can you build a space that can make us think differently, that can be civically important and interesting without all of this money required? And I think that part of that is that's sort of, you know, that's a structural problem for the field of park development. You know, I don't want to say that, you know, resistance is futile at all, because I know that there are groups in Austin, Texas, who have for now successfully pushed back against a sort of privatized sort of takeover and makeover of parks in downtown Austin. So I think that these issues are increasingly on people's radar. And I think that, you know, one of the issues, you know, I talked about this a bit with people in Philadelphia, you know, a year or so ago, where I feel like the political sort of fissures are a little bit unique in a lot of these U.S. cities, which are, you know, tend to be heavily, you know, progressive politically. And so there is a sort of, I think that there is a sort of fissure that isn't always visible in terms of, I think, a lot of people who identify as being politically liberal want to get involved, want to be part of, you know, helping their local community, want to be part of, you know, what's the local organization that's taking care of parks? I'm going to go volunteer for them. And I think that there's a sort of, oftentimes there's a lack of sort of the sort of looking at the more urban scale and looking at which communities have resources, which communities are receiving resources for parks, and which ones would really benefit from getting more, and having that be driven, in my opinion, more by the public realm, more and really kind of building social movements that force city governments to fund parks in a more equitable way, and really trying to remove these private groups from the equation. And I it is discouraging to see how embedded these and expected these private groups are in our contemporary parks landscape. But I am hopeful, because I think there is so much increasing awareness. And certainly what I try to, you know, advocate for in the book and by laying out this history for people is to kind of see, you know, these things, these parks that might seem so great, there's a lot more there that oftentimes isn't so great. And I think the more people are at least aware of some of those political dynamics, I think the more people can kind of question in their own communities, you know, who has the resources and how can I be involved politically to try to make things more equitable?
Mm. What an interesting answer on that point. And it's summed up kind of and brought together so many aspects of the book. So a great way, I think, to end our discussion about the book as well. I do, however, have one final question. What might you be working on now that this book is obviously off your desk? Are there any kind of current or upcoming projects you'd like to briefly preview?
Oh, sure. So I've sort of, through working on this book, I've increasingly been in the sort of urban adaptation, climate adaptation sort of world. And so I've been working on a project for a long time about sort of looking at how sort of home buyouts have sort of transformed flood-prone communities in the U.S. And so that's something that people can go on my Google Scholar page if they're interested in that. And that's an ongoing thing. And then the other big project I'm working on is a little bit different, not so much in the sort of urban environmental world, but I'm co-authoring a book with my friend Jordan Conwell. We have a contract with the University of Chicago Press, looking at the sort of sociological research methodologies of W.E.B. Du Bois, who is someone that we've both had a longstanding interest in our own sort of subfields of sociology, and coming together to write something that says it'll be a little different from Parks for Profit. But I'm appreciative of anyone who reads Parks for Profit, and if you liked what you read, then I would be grateful for your future support of this next book, because I think it'll be really great too.
Well, thank you for that preview. Always fun to get a sneak peek after discussing a book. And of course, while you're working on that, listeners can read the book we've been talking about, again, titled Parks for Profit, Selling Nature in the City, published by Columbia University Press. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. I really appreciate it. It was great talking with you.